Nice newsletter, guys. Yeah. Actually, just before we start the class, I just wanted to make some awards, and I can't make awards to everybody, so you'll just have to hit on the people that I'm making awards to, the rest of you. What I've done is I've brought a pagoda for three couples here. Is that good? So certainly for Don and Pat McKenzie, see? to let them express the sweetness and the nourishment of their wonderful work. And the second one to Kathy and Bob for allowing us to, you know, invade their living quarters and do with it as we wish again, and the nourishment and the sweetness of that. And like I said, they can't open it in the class, so after the class there's a certain so thank you very much as well. And the last one to Wayne and Francine for their ongoing continuous support to the group and their good heart for Donna. So again, like, you know, this is something that, you know, they should use as nourishment for all beings. So like,
pass it back. Oh, no.
So three pagodas.
You said we're not supposed to open it in the class, though.
In the class, after the class. Okay. That just gives everybody a chance. Look at that. He knows what to do with it. Francine, don't leave the room. And I really appreciate your continued interest in Dharma. You have some idea, I think, because I've told you so many times, screamed it at you, yelled it at you, cried it at you, how important your practice is to me. And that because you do this practice and you have this heart for the end of suffering, not only for yourselves but for others, it makes me a very difficult task, but you do keep me honest. Mm. And I appreciate that.
Maybe we should give the devotees back.
I notice she isn't saying that. And there is the story.
That's the relationship in a nutshell.
Yeah, one of you says one thing and the other says one on the other hand. Which is the value. Okay, so 19, my gosh, do you believe we're at 19? Isn't that amazing? Just plowing through this. How many years is it? 4 years?
1990. I think actually I got a tape from 1999.
With the first one?
2000 for sure.
2000, November. It's 5 years?
We were on page 48 on November 2000 because I recorded that class.
Oh, wow.
Just recently.
Oh, wow.
We were leaving, and it's December of 2000, we left the introduction.
Oh, there we go.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So, this has really been a long haul. We only have that many more pages here. It's pretty good.
10 years, yeah, 10 years.
So, I'm sort of two minds. We could pick up where we left off, or we could start at the beginning of this one again. And I think it might be useful just to take it in whole context to start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I'm more leaning toward that. What do you think?
Beginning of
19. Mm-hmm. We were one page, we were on page 209. And I think it might be nice if we started at the beginning and of that one, starting on page 207. Is that all right with everybody? Anybody have any major complaints? Because you can still leave if you want. Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Sadhu. So this is about two kinds of thought, and I'm sure that you have all noticed these two kinds of thoughts in your day. I don't think you're that different from me. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One, who you know is the Buddha, was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty." There are two footnotes in that chapter. Shall we just flip through them very quickly? 236, 235. The first one is, the Bodhisattva's twofold division of thought occurred during a six-year struggle for enlightenment. The second footnote is, thoughts of non-ill will and thoughts of non-cruelty may all be also be explained positively as thoughts of loving-kindness for non-ill will and thoughts of compassion, karuna, for non-cruelty. Okay? Straightforward? So there he is sitting there thinking as usual, and then he says to himself, gee, suppose I divided my thoughts. Looked up, named them, which ones were which, right? As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. You notice he had to keep doing it? Mm-hmm. That's like four times, isn't it? Mm-hmm. At least. Who knows how many times he had to do each one? You know, our age of instant gratification. Well, I tried to change my thoughts, but I just wanted, you just kept coming back. Well, yeah. So change it again. It's always the first time. Right? You could either be a victim, or you can see whether it works. Isn't that true? Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. A thought of cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own afflictions, to others' afflictions, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from enlightenment. When I considered this, thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. Isn't that nice? Isn't that just a nice little statement? Whatever you habituate will become a habit. Whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of non-cruelty to cultivate the thought of cruelty, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. Just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. Because he can see the punishment from not doing that. Nice, huh? Mm-hmm. So, too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and when the mind is disturbed, is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose in me. A thought of non-cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-cruelty has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire the body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and when the mind is disturbed, it's far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally and quieted it, brought it to singleness and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. Anytime, you have a question, Marie? Basically, letting go of becoming. In the book that we're studying in Calgary called Orderly Chaos, Trungpa Rinpoche talks about how you get up in the morning and you're already at war. You got your war planned out. You're going, okay, first you're going to eat breakfast so that you'll be prepared to. And this kind of quality of never being where you are. You know, the blessed state of being in the embrace of the perfect lover, rather than becoming perfect so that you can find a lover. Whatever may be. Do you understand that? So renunciation is renouncing your need to obey the feeling that you have to go to the next moment. Renunciation, because trying to get the next moment has to do with trying to be safe, trying to be loved, trying to have power, trying to have position or possessions, doesn't it? And anybody doesn't think that's true? So whenever you're caught in self-grasping, you're not able to see the present moment as it is, because you're looking for something other than what is present. Is that clear? So long as we are caught by looking for something other than that which is present, We'll never know whether what we want is already here. Or as my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche told me many years ago, you know, Cecily, a child who's crying because they want a piece of cake has to stop crying before they can see the cake in front of them waiting for them to eat it. Truly. So renunciation is letting go of what you think you want and finding out what you do have. There is this desire, and it's always running. Is that you? That's one of the first things you find out. Oh no, at one moment I can desire something, the next moment I can be grateful I don't have it. Is that true? I think we've all done that at least once. So renunciation is renouncing being driven by desire, being driven by becoming, becoming the next moment. And it's very much like, you know, choosing your thoughts is not something you do one time and that's it.
Yeah.
But the aspiration to be present with what is present, with it in an open state, is a step. The great step toward renunciation. Because all the other actions are involved with self-grasping or self-clinging. Is that good?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Are we on 11?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. Hmm, it works with the positive too. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm, we'll all be. Hmm. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. Sensual desire is, oh, that will make me happy, oh, this will make me happy. Oh, as soon as class is over, we get some chocolate. You know? Oh, did I say that? I wonder where that thought came from. Sensual desire is that kind of mind that keeps going. You know? Maybe this, maybe this, maybe this. Always for what you don't have. Is that clear? And to actually see that and know it's not you, it's a thought, and that you can, if you keep sowing it, you will keep reaping it, and you're the one in charge of your thoughts, and change the tape, so different music is playing in the elevator, because your elevator. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, of being where you are. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-cruelty. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought into the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there, so too there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. Mm. See, once you've established the wholesome, you don't have to prod them and poke them and get rid of them. Isn't that nice?
Mm.
The work is to break the old pattern. You have to keep prodding the mind back to the path you want to go. But once the crops are there, once the crops are gathered, you've already got the wholesome. All you got to do is make sure you don't stray into dangerous ground. It's a lot less work. I love his analogies. Mm-hmm. I think they're very, very alcoholic. Most of us have never prodded a cow in our lives. If you get the image, it's there. Tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified, because when your mind isn't using up energy wishing for an experience other than that which is present, it's amazing how much energy and clarity there is. When I get tired, it's because I start wishing for an experience like that it was already Thursday or something, next week or something like that, you know? That kind of thought, oh, that's when my retreat starts. You understand what I'm saying? That when you look, imagining something happening that you really want, there's a lot of energy in that rather than energy in where you are. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana. And this is as far as we got last time. Does that sound familiar to you, those of you who are here? So then he went to, I think it's page 50, 60, oh yeah, I picked it down. Page 105, those of you who have the text, where he is asked about, a Brahmin goes to him and asks, as when somebody becomes and goes to do the meditation to awaken, what do they have a teacher? Do they have the Buddha for the guide, and how do they do it, and what do they do, and where do they go? And he says, but the Buddha says, yeah, they should have a good guide. And then the Brahmin says, but Master Gotama, remote jungle thicket, resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. It's hard to enjoy solitude. I'd love to do a retreat, but I can't stand the thought of doing a retreat. Can I take my Game Boy with me? Well, it doesn't say Game Boy, but other than that, it's all here. One would think the jungles must rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he has no concentration. That's good, isn't it? Rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he doesn't have concentration. And the Buddha says, that's true. They are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice, and it's hard to enjoy solitude. And the jungles would rob the bhikkhu of his mind if he didn't have a sense of good concentration. And then he says, well, I also thought that. And then he goes through all the things he learned about morality and how to balance the energy so the mind didn't go to the unwholesome. And then how to... It's so beautiful, the whole thing. And then how to identify clarity of wisdom, of seeing what was important and what wasn't important, and then developing the jhanas. You know what jhanas are? Anybody doesn't know what jhanas are? Everybody knows. Anybody?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's why you put your hand up and say, I don't know. So you can be more educated than everybody else here. Because I might be even more erudite. Jhanas are basically states of absorption. When you feel comfortable and at ease and in the present moment, you know that you are just absorbed in the present. When something is a little scary or you don't feel comfortable, you know your mind is darting around. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
When you're at ease and happy, you're relaxed in the present moment. Is that true? And when you start to get anxious or disturbed, your mind starts darting around. Is that true? So what the jhanas are is training your mind to be concentrated regardless of the circumstances. And how do you do that? What makes a mind jump around and what makes a mind concentrated? What makes a mind concentrated is the ability to focus on one point without being distracted by other objects, right? When you are looking at, like, the sunset tonight was so exquisite. Did you see it? It was just, I think probably driving up here it was more beautiful because it was just the way that the clarity and then the clouds lighting up, it was really exquisite. And when you're looking at something that's absolutely beautiful, I had to stop the car, stand by the road and watch it. So beautiful. It's like you're not aware particularly, you know, you put yourself out of the way of the traffic. But you're not aware particularly of cars passing or anything. You're just aware of just the beauty of the moment. Is that true? And so that when you're really concentrated, like if you've had a child, the first time you ever held your first child, the very first time, and you're just like totally concentrated, aren't you? It's like, what pain if you gave birth? You know? What pain? Oh my God. Look at his feet right now. It's like total bliss, isn't it? Something changes in you. It's like totally different. Because there's this absolute concentration and at one moment with that moment. That would be called first jhana. When you develop the ability to hold that focus and that concentration so your mind is not going around to seeing, you know, who's elbowing you aside because your wife is, you're holding your child and your wife is actually bleeding to death and they're trying to fix her. You know, like, oh, there's another world too. You know, like that kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? Was that too Cecily's mind off the wall for you?
No.
That was okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually develop the ability to not be distracted from that state of concentration, and it goes even deeper so that there is no peripheral thought at all. You're not really aware for a moment of anything around you. You're aware of what you're looking at, but there isn't any peripheral thought, oh, that's a car going by or anything. That's called second jhana. That means that the concentration has become even more powerful so that your mind is not darting around at all. It's just focused in one point. So you develop that ability to hold that focus stronger and stronger. And it gets to a state more and more profound joyfulness, blissfulness, at one moment with the moment. Until, so that there are four stages of that where there's still awareness of subject-object. And then the mind goes into a state that is like a mystical experience or something where there isn't any sense of self. There's no subject-object. There is just a sense of total absorption, which some of you maybe have experienced in orgasm. Which is why the image of orgasm is often used to describe the bliss in the Tibetan tradition. You know, the union, the yab-yum figures. To show that total at-one-ment with the moment. That total at-one-ment. And there are four stages of that, of developing that at-one-ment that are more and more profound. So, and sometimes it's divided, the first four jhanas are actually divided into five, but usually they're done in four. So there are either eight or nine jhanas that are delineated, and actually there are teachers that teach them, and you practice doing those jhanas. I had the good fortune of studying with such a teacher when I lived in Thailand. And it's very, very lovely to have that kind of time to actually learn what your mind really is rather than what you think it is. Your mind is not necessarily what you think. The thoughts are something that's playing any more than the wind is the same thing as space. Space is space, the wind is the wind. Is that useful? So jhana is like basically called absorption or concentration. And some translations call it trance. Not my favorite translation. So in the 4th sutra, he gives this whole description of how he developed jhana. Rapture, born of concentration, third jhana, abided in the fourth jhana, and then with the experience of the fourth jhana, it's very close to understanding what understanding how consciousness can abide without subject-object duality, without an object to define the self, how there can still be consciousness, which is a very important part of the Buddhist teaching. Because we spend so much of our times being in relation to, and to actually have an experience of being conscious without subject-object is really a relief. Because so long as you're in relation to, there's always going to be something out of your control.
I am.
Have you noticed? You know? You have noticed that. Oh, good. I was a little worried there. So having that sense of a concentrated mind, and in the Fourth Sutra, he talks about when he got to fourth jhana, to that state of still within subject-object, but very refined concentration, then he started tracing back previous lives. He started watching the coming into being and passing away. And previous lives can be within 1 minute. As you know, if you pay attention, how much the sense of self comes into being and passes away. Mm-hmm. You know, the self that came in this room is not the same self that's sitting here now. Have you noticed that? Mm-hmm. And I'm not even talking about the chocolate here. But just the ideas or the awareness of whether your legs are sore or, you know? The sense of when you came in and how, whether you were happy or sad, or whether now you're getting intrigued by it, or you wish I wouldn't keep saying the same stuff I say every time I come up here. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So it's like this continuous coming into being and passing away of subject-object, isn't there? So maybe he's tracing 100,000 of them that happened in the 5 minutes. Or maybe he's taking longer ones, like how did the hair come into being in my head, and tracing it over, you know, into the womb. How the through the DNA, how the information to grow hair on your head came into activity in your being. Doesn't particularly say, except he does say that first he said to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. And then he goes, I recollected my manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births. So watching, looking back and saying, okay, tracing, coming into being and passing away in the past. If you remember from other discourses or other teachings that we have done together as a group, I've told you before, when the Buddha felt that once somebody had established calm abiding, that the meditation could go one of three ways. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. And what are the three ways?
Uh-huh.
Hi, dear.
Non-dual, calm abiding, and insight.
No, you got one right. Non-dual, I almost pass, except I don't think you mean it the same way. You got insight. Once you establish calm abiding, then there are three ways you can develop meditation according to the Buddha. What are they? Kathy, you said you knew. You said you remembered. Do you actually remember? Come on, don't disappear on me. Be yourself. Do you remember?
No.
Thank you. Is that a no? Was that a no? Okay, would you say it again?
No.
Thank you. Okay, so anybody want to take a stab at it? Once you have established calm abiding, said the Buddha, then there are three ways. You don't remember this from the Red Deer class? Mm-hmm. Three ways to take meditation practice. This is what the Buddha said. These are your career choices as a meditator. So you might want to write this, because maybe you want to check this, see which one would look the best on your resume, you know? First way is jhana. Develop greater and greater power of holding the mind at one-pointedness. This is particularly useful for people that are caught in defining themselves in relation to who have an idea of what they need to attain. Is that clear? Who are really a little bit tense about their performance. Why would that be useful? Because if you experience jhana, it kicks itself right out of the picture. There's no subject-object relationship. Suddenly, the narrowness of that view is gone. Is this starting to sound a little familiar? Mm-hmm. What's the second one?
Psychic powers,
exactly. Second one, and what he's talking about here, developing psychic powers once you establish karma body. Why psychic powers? One of the number one psychic power meditations that you do, which I've also had the great good fortune of being given instruction on and doing, is looking at past lives. What is that good for? People who get very blissed out, like, you know, if they've taken a lot of acid or something, you know, or have really good background to support them, and they can go into all life as one without too much problem, you know, that one. But who can experience very profound states of beatitude, but not bring insight into it, not see the state. Do you understand that? So that you know that you could live in a very nice house and actually think it was yours. Do you think that's true? But then one day, you know, a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy will arise. The bulldozers will appear on your block and start moving toward it, right? And what's your reaction?
Anger.
You bet.
This is my house!
Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. So like that, there is this assumption once you experience a state that transcends what you have previously known as at-one-ment. You actually think you've arrived somewhere. But if you don't bring insight into it to clearly see it as it is, it's true that a state of at-one-ment is a great way, the mind is clear enough that you can ask a decent question then. But if you don't ask the question, then what happens is you live there, and then pretty soon, you know, the universe groans and shifts and, you know, shrugs its shoulders, and that iceberg starts to roll, and that what was the tip is now no longer the tip, and some other place is up there, and you're down. Is that clear? So awareness of cause and effect, but like doing it specifically by tracing back. So all the meditations on the psychic powers, six psychic powers, which I've talked about other times, and I'm not going to go into there because I'm going off way too long here anyway, are to develop awareness of the laws of existence. The mind of clarity. Jhana is to develop the mind of wisdom. And the third one is to develop, and this is the Theravadin tradition, the third one is to develop insight. So once you establish a certain state of calm abiding, there are three ways, according to the Buddha. Over and over again, he directed his practitioners to train either jhanas or psychic powers or insight. And there was a specific reason for each of them. Is that interesting to you?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty interesting.
Could there be someone that would be interested in all three and develop all three?
Oh yeah. I have done all three meditations, all three types. Mm-hmm. Certainly have not mastered all three, but I've had experience of all three with very good teachers. It's difficult in the West to get people who teach jhana well, because there's kind of a snobbery about jhana in the West at the moment. Have you noticed that? most people are more interested in insight. You don't really want to develop those states of concentration because they're not insight. Have you noticed that? I feel like there's a kind of a snobbery there. People always talk about the real thing, insight. But without concentration, you can't, without that ability to hold the mind steady, you can't have an insight. Which is what that number four talks about, how first you have to be able to concentrate in the jungle before you can have insight.
So is concentration and wisdom more or less the same in this
one? Yeah. Because concentration is jhana. And the experience of jhana, once you experience the formless jhana, there is a clear understanding that there is no inherent self. That when there is an object, there is a subject, and it's changing all the time. Before you have that experience really clearly, you actually think you are somebody. I am this, or I want that. And you live your life as though that were true, don't you? And you're continuously relating in terms of objects, so you never get to see the gap, the little gap between subject-object. And when it does come up, you can't trust it. You have to fill it up with the next wanting. Because there's this sense that if I'm not here in relation, who am I? Maybe I don't exist. But maybe that I doesn't exist. Maybe that's what they call in Buddhism illusion. We're kind of getting off the sutra a little bit, but I think these are good questions. So.
But if you have psychic powers, does that not develop wisdom, and does that not give you insight?
If you're talking about psychic powers in terms of Buddhism or in terms of our language, it would be a very different thing.
So they don't. One doesn't develop the other.
I think when people talk about psychic powers in our culture, they're really talking about the speech body. It's called the speech body. Awareness of different planes of existence. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the psychic powers that can be developed, but that's certainly, you know, I think when we talk about psychic powers, we talk about people who believe in, you know, da da da, and it's kind of very limited, and there's this, you know, there's this kind of a restriction on what that means. But in the Buddhist tradition, there are six psychic powers, and they're very specific. And one of them has to do with more like being able to, you know, like they are laws, they are rules, they are, you know. My beloved teacher Ananda Bodhi said one time, if you ever find that something is not working for you, then what you need to do is find a law that will change that law. The idea of realizing the interconnectedness and the weavings, which has to do with insight, which has to do with seeing cause and effect. It isn't necessarily so that somebody who has a gift for seeing cause and effect or psychic powers in our language would also have wisdom, because wisdom means the understanding of no inherent self. And very often, especially in our culture, because people who have psychic powers are considered to be like minority, you know, there isn't the clear appreciation that to some degree we all have psychic powers, and some people are much more skilled in it, like we all can hear music, but some people are great pianists, you know, it's not quite looked at in the same sneering way as being gay or something, but they are sort of like not quite in the mainstream kind of thought to it, you know. So it's very hard to escape having an identity when one is very proficient in those things, because it's almost like she has, or he has, or... Does that make sense?
So
So you have to have psychic powers without identity.
You need to have an experience that there is no inherent identity and the power of understanding cause and effect and clarity about nothing arises without cause. Nothing arises without cause. Number two, clarity. Whatever is causal is impermanent. So he's tracing back the causes. He's seeing that this ceases and this arises, this ceases. Nothing arises without cause. Whatever is causal is impermanent. And if you actually look at the psychic powers, all of them, they're all about understanding cause and effect, but in different levels of existence. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
In one way, they're very scientific. Aren't they?
I would say so.
I would say so, too. But that, you know, it doesn't mean that a scientist can't be proud of their ability to theorize or perform great experiments in a lab. Like the sense of no inherent self is a different story again. And really what you need is the balance of the two. When those two, understanding that nothing arises without cause and whatever is causal is impermanent, and that there is no inherent identity. And having both of those in some kind of balanced way, we all have both of them, but usually one, you know, this person will depend on this one more and that person will depend on that one more. But for to really perform insight, you need both of those really well balanced. If this is information on if you would like to awaken next weekend.
Okay.
What you gotta do is balance these two.
Which two?
Jhana or concentration to the point of really being clearly perceiving, experiencing, knowing the truth of no inherent identity. That you don't have to grasp after objects because you can be concentrated in the here and now without identity. Is that clear? And that it's blissful, not freaky. Right? And number two, nothing arises without cause. Whatever is causal is impermanent. So you could say, no thingness. You could. I just did. But whether it means anything or not, it's up to you. So when those are in a good balance, and like, you know, some of us like really cling to a sense of self, and when that one actually lets go a little bit, you start seeing the emptiness. There's this joy, isn't there? It's like joy. I mean, you have no idea what it is to download yourself. Oh, hands down, what a load. It's quite delicious. Any more questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
So are you saying the scientist who says I'm a scientist is a self?
Is involved with subject object.
Right. And if he says, the scientist says, I can theorize, or I am theorizing right now.
He can still say, I'm a scientist, but he knows that there is no I. Then he's balanced.
So he can theorize.
Knows.
He can theorize.
No, if he says, I am a scientist, but he knows there is no I, then there is balance. If he says, I'm a scientist, and he has an identity, there's no balance. Be saying exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the saying. It's who's saying it. And you can tell by the level of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to give up our meanings, we gotta go through some very big fear, don't we? I mean, to actually be in the present moment, you have to give up all your meanings, don't you? All your purposes, all your great vows, your identities, carefully framed portraits in the hall. Your special cookie recipes. Oh, no, that's me. No, I'm not giving that. Maybe next week. Does that make sense? This is like the basic kind of Buddha Dharma. It's very beautiful, I think. It's very clear. Gives you a really good sense of what it is you're working for. Because if there is no inherent I, if that's true, then when you die, what have you got to fear? Only the shock that you think that there was an that there was a fixed identity. But there is some kind of continuum because there is cause and effect. Nothing arises without cause. Whatever is causal is impermanent. But when there is cause, there will be an effect. So it's a really interesting little play, isn't it? So should we go back to the main one? Is that good? Because you just talked about the jhanas and I can sort of hear. How are we doing? Oh, pretty good here. So in this 14 to 23, it says, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana. And I directly knew. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. So he goes through the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, then he reviews coming into beings and passings away, and then he goes, he gives the whole description of how he awakened in the fourth sutra. And so at the end of that, it says here, by verse 32 he's described it, and then he's saying here, I directly knew birth is destroyed. And as there is no longer being subject to becoming. No longer being subject to becoming.
Is that, but there is still becoming.
So why don't you check it out and see? Or the Buddha said there is suffering but no one suffering. No more subject to becoming. Very intriguing, isn't it?
Yes.
And it requires an experience beyond subject object to perceive. So we're thinking about it as still subject object. It's a really nice koan.
Mm-hmm.
This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the third watch of the night. Third true knowledge. The first true knowledge was there is dissatisfactoriness. The second true knowledge was it arises with cause. The third one, there is a cessation. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. This happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and remote, and resolute. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path that led to their happiness. And he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another man came desiring their good, welfare, and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness. He closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Bhikkhus, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path, that is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good welfare and protection is a term for the Tathagata accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path that led to their happiness is a term for the noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So because the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me, the wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, and the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted to hear the Blessed One's words.
Beautiful sutra, huh?
Mm-hmm. Any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints on that one? Shall we plunge ahead then? Mm-hmm. Number 20!
You don't have copies.
Huh?
You don't have copies?
You don't have copies? Oh my goodness, you didn't have much.
It's on page only 211. Mm-hmm.
211 is there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You got one page.
One page only.
It's only two pages. Oh no, yeah it is. One, two, three and a half pages. We might finish 20 tonight. Mm-hmm.
Wow, we're racing.
Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anatha Pindaka's Park. Same place as the last one, right? There he addressed the bhikkhus as bhikkhus. Venerable sir, they replied. Same as the last one, too. The Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign and owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. Then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. Footnote 240. When thoughts of sensual desire arise directed toward living beings, the other sign is the meditation on foulness. When you start meditating on, gee, how nice it would be to be with that lovely partner that you had who was just like so, the skin was like, and geez, and how they understood you, and how nice it was to curl up with them, then immediately you imagine a booger hanging out of their nose. Do you understand that? Mm-hmm. That what that does is it cuts the mind of becoming a hungry ghost. Because when your mind, in psychological parlance of the day, it's called ghostly lover. When you're thinking about something other than what is present, it can become even more attractive than it ever was in person.
Mm-hmm.
and that you become like unable to relate to the world because the ghostly lover is demanding all your heart, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking, when you're meditating, for example, and you start imagining something that you really want, an incredible bowl of gazpacho, and it's there, and you can almost see it steaming in front of you, imagine somebody hawking into it. Yeah. So as I call meditation on the unwholesome, or meditations on the foul, and there are specific ones that are done, but basically the idea is sensuality, it's just is like a marsh. It just wanting desire for an experience other than that which is present is like quicksand, and you will just fall in that. And what you want to do is give yourself solid ground, so you introduce the unwholesome, because sensuality just has you salivating and moving forward, and hatred, dislike, causes you to back up and be where you are. Right? So it is useful, said the Buddha, from time to time to find the unbeautiful in the beautiful. Why? So that no lust arises in you. From time to time to find the beautiful in the unbeautiful. Why? So that no hatred arises in you. So that the mind remains clear. Clear comprehension and awareness. So that's what these signs are talking about. Thoughts of sensual desire arise directed toward living beings. The other sign is the meditation on foulness. For example, as a corpse with worms eating its body. And, you know, those are the ones. Charming. When the thoughts are directed to inanimate things, the other sign is attention to impermanence. When thoughts of hate arise directed toward living beings, the other sign is the meditation on loving kindness. When they are directed to inanimate things, the other sign is attention to the elements, seeing it made up of earth, water, fire, air. The remedy for thoughts connected with delusion is living under a teacher, studying the Dharma, inquiring into its meaning, listening to the Dharma, and inquiring into the causes. It's starting to think clearly. Pretty straightforward. The antidote to delusion is thinking clearly. Not just letting your view overwhelm things as they are. Okay, so that's... When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With this abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentration. If while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome, they are reprehensible, they result in suffering. When he examines the danger in these thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of these, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, concentrated, just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or neck, his or her neck. So too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. If while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a booklet tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. I like these stuff. Isn't this nice? This is good tool book. If while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. Okay, now we got another footnote. Is this 241? Or is this 242? I thought it was 242. And in Vitaka Sankara Santanam, Vitaka Sankara Santanam, right. Vitaka is thought, Sankara condition, the condition of thought, what is the root or the cause of the thought, and takes the compound to mean stopping the cause of the thought. That's nice, isn't it? Because thoughts always arise with cause, don't they? This is accomplished by inquiring when an unwholesome thought has arisen, what is the cause of this thought? What is the cause of the cause of that thought? Like you can be sitting there and you can start, and you can suddenly find yourself being really pissed off at your sister because she took your xylophone away from you, and then you say, what was the cause of that thought? And then you realize you just heard an ice cream truck going by outside. And you say, well, what was the cause of that cause? And you understand? Mm-hmm. So that you trace the cause backward. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Until you're no longer intrigued by that, by just getting on that train and riding down the track on it. Such an inquiry, according to, brings about a slackening and eventually the cessation of the flow of unwholesome thought. It does. It does. Yeah.
So you're not really trying to figure out anything about it.
No, you're just trying to see why that arose in your mind. Why did that arise now? Why did that arise now? What's the cause of that? What? Sometimes some insight teachers, they teach, you know, watch which sense door did that thought come from. They give it more specific. Mm-hmm. Some insight teachers, I've studied with insight teachers who did that, and I've studied with insight teachers who say, say you're watching a thought and you take, and this is a little, this takes a little more skill, but it's really kind of a neat exercise, and you know how I love puzzles, so of course I like this one. It's like, so you notice the thought, you take the last four words of the thought, and then we can eat chocolate, and you take those four words and you say, take the word chocolate and you think, okay, that's the fourth word, and what's the third word? That's the fourth word, and then what's the third word? Eat. Okay, eat. And what's the second word? Can. And what's the first word? We. Okay, we can eat chocolate. Okay, chocolate can eat we. Okay, we can. And sometimes just doing that stops the thought. But then if it doesn't, what you're trying to do is say, okay, what was that thought? And then what was the thought that led to that? Like, what was, there's usually a series of thoughts. And when you can get four thoughts back, and it's almost 9:30. It's almost 9 o'clock. Pretty soon I can move. I'm starting to get sleepy in this room. There's not much oxygen here. And when the class is over, we'll go downstairs and then we can eat chocolate. And then we can eat chocolate. When the class is over, we go downstairs. You understand? Mm-hmm. You go back four thoughts, and then you try to see what was the motive that took you from one thought to the other. Mm-hmm. And then you go back, that motive linked to that one, right? So it's looking at cause a slightly different way, but it's still looking at cause. And that's really interesting, but you really do need to be in retreat, I think, to do that one. Because the mind just keeps springing off at any one of them. But I found that one quite amazing, how quickly the mind just went still. So both of those, the one where you say which sense door triggered that thought, that works too, and it, it took, for me, maybe just because I'm such a complicated, you know, I love complications so much. Maybe for me, that second one had more clarity. The first one certainly brings a state of clarity, but it wasn't that kind of ringing kind of clarity that when you're looking at the stars at night on a cold night, you get that kind of spacious clarity, you know? So, but play with it, see what you find. Is that good?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So are we on 6? No, we're on, yeah, 242, yeah. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. Because they always come in groups. If there's something you dislike, your mind will start going to all other things you've disliked. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Did you know that? Have you ever been mad at somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Or did you find yourself waiting for them to come home or waiting until you could see them? Huh?
Mm-hmm.
And what were you doing when you were waiting? You're going over your file folders?
Yes.
And do they go, are they just for that incident?
No.
What are they for?
Lifetimes.
And you can remember every time, okay?
Yeah.
And you embellish a few just to add them in. You put them more as case studies and footnotes, but they're there to give bulk to them, right? Because when you use one emotion, all the other times of that emotion come up too. Is that clear? The speech body is more like a globe. The energy of emotion is more like when you're happy, you can remember all the times you were happy. Is that true? When you're sad, you can remember why the whole world might as well fucking blow up because it's not worth any shit pile anyway. Right? Of course, none of you are use that kind of language or talk in that way. I understand I'm the only one who does that, and it's very kind of you to put up with me. However, when you're jealous, you can see how you never get anything and they always get it and you deserve it, and it's a really, and you'd like to see them just die of it. Right? And when you're caught in pride, you don't want anybody to interfere with what you know is right, and you're always establishing your territory. Isn't that true? All of those are very true, aren't they? So the speech body is like a globe. The body, the physical body, is linear time, past, present, future. Is that clear? So that when there is greed or hatred or delusion or pride or jealousy, it will link up with every other moment of that, if you let it. So it's like being on a treadmill and thinking I can never get off it. All you gotta do is just step sideways, you're off it. But you don't believe in sideways when you're in one of those globes. So it says here, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, gives attention to how to stop the belief in those, to just examine them rather than be them, right? Then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him, then immediately it stops. As soon as you get out of it, it stops. Isn't that true? With the abandoning of his mind, your mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated, right? But then 1 second later, you might think, well, I missed that. And then you jump right back in again,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
But you can jump back out again, too. And you say, well, what's the point of getting out? Because I'll just get back in again.
Yeah.
On the other hand, what's the point of getting in? Because you're going to just get out again. Like, give me a break, folks. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? Walk slowly. Then he might consider, am I walking slowly? What if I stand? He would stand, he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? If he would sit, he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? See, like it's all possible. and he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler.
What a concept.
So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of these thoughts, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated, and rather than walking fast, he's walking slower, then he walks slower, he's like standing, he's standing, his mind starts sitting. When his mind is sitting, it rests in the moment, rather than on the emotional treadmill. Isn't that beautiful? I love his analogies. Eh? If while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush with mind. Crush mind with mind. Wow. 243. He should crush the unwholesome state of mind with a wholesome state of mind. Mm. Number one wholesome state of mind when something you really dislike is present. Number one wholesome state of mind is it is also impermanent. Do I want to keep going back to something that is dying and dissolving anyway? Isn't that right? Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. But there are many ways to do it. You find this interesting?
Yes.
I like that. Teeth clenched and his tongue crashed against the roof of his mouth. His dentures fell out. No. Because when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign and knowing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then even when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. Any of you ever done feeding the demons exercise, you know how true that is. And with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him, and his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. The bhikkhu is then called a master in the courses of thought. Isn't that beautiful? Courses, like the courses of a river, you know, flowing. Master in the flows of thought. Isn't that beautiful? He will think whatever thought he wishes to think. My goodness. How delicious. And he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. And if he doesn't wish to think, his mind is just clear and empty with full awareness. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit. What was that word?
Conceit.
My goodness. He has made an end of suffering. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That's number 21. No, that was number 20. Sorry. Beautiful, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Can you read the comment about conceit again?
He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end to suffering.
So how does conceit work in that?
Conceit is grasping. It's like grasping for I am better than, or I am worse than, or I am equal to. Conceit is grasping for subject-object relationship. People can be very conceited about their poverty. People can be very conceited about their richness. People can be very conceited about how they're as good as everybody else. I can be very conceited about all three, flipping from one to the other within a very short period of time. That's interesting, isn't it? Because they're so like different from each other, aren't they? But it depends on, you know, when my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche was around and, you know, invited me over for dinner or something, and I would go through those three like I was, you know, cycling really fast in a park. One minute I was like better than everybody, the next minute I was worse than everybody, the next minute, oh yeah, I'm as good as you. And all different masks, you know, like flinging them on and off, costume changes faster than you would believe. Makeup was right there. And from sophisticated to street girl, you know, I mean, just like boom. So some of you know that one. Right? And all of it, I was grasping for an identity in relation to, right? And that's what all the thoughts are too, aren't they? All those kinds of thoughts are always grasping for relationship for identity in relation to. When you actually learn what the real relationship is that is most useful to you, that is most satisfying, that is not dependent on cause. You know? Then you pierce through that conceit. Nice, huh?
So in that, if you're grasping, then is that when the thought, well, everything is impermanent, comes in? Just see it
perhaps,
as
perhaps. That's, you know, he's given five different ways here, hasn't he? That's what it says, there are five signs. Or five ways. Yet another list. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Do you elaborate a little bit on the relationship beyond subject-object, the last thing that you had mentioned?
And basically, what gives you a sense of that is any total blissful moment of kindness or love or sense of at-one-ment. Gives you a little taste of that, or jhana. Or, you know, sometimes when you're meditating, you have this peacefulness occur. Imagine that just magnified just a little more. There isn't anything that you need or don't need, is there? Everything is just what it is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't any subject-object relating in that state, right? And that becomes so clear that that is your natural state of being. Because that is what, from a Buddhist point of view, that is what it is. That is mind. That clarity without contrivance. And the other thing about mind is that it's without limit. Clear and boundless. Vast. So that means no fixed identities. So to actually experience that and be able to manifest in form is called enlightenment. I think it would be a really good trick. I'm working hard at trying to get that one down. I notice some of you are too. Is that all right? Any other questions, answers? You know? It's a very beautiful book, isn't it? Very beautiful resource. I think
like really gives you a powerful sense of what is involved in the Buddhist teaching. What it's really about, you know? Then you can use various rituals to attain these ends, but these are the ends. Because ritual is very useful, isn't it? Basically, learning how to grit your teeth and push your tongue to the roof of your mouth and press down mind with mind could be a ritual, couldn't it? Can't you see that as Mahakala?
Morris would have liked to have heard that.
Huh?
Morris would have liked to have heard that.
He would so.
Because I remember him, something about the ego, bashing the ego, so I don't know, some kind of fight he was talking about.
Yeah, I remember that too. Another round. Nice to remember him, nice to remember Blaine, nice to remember these people. We're fortunate, aren't we? With our friends. We do that so often. So, any other questions, answers, comments, complaints? Did you look at Mars through the telescope? Did you guys look at it while it was big?
Yours are off.
Oh, yeah. Is it hard to get them on?
I'm having trouble with them.
Wow.
That's okay. I think I just need a bigger telescope.
You probably, and if you're going to have a new house, you'll need a bigger telescope. I don't see how you could possibly not have one.
Holes in the universe.
Yeah. There's somebody with her hand over her mouth in the back room.
Just ignore her. She'll
get stellar in even. Okay, so we're done for tonight. Tomorrow's my night. I better think of something to talk about, eh?
It's going to be hard.
Yeah. You notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts? It spreads through your body. Tickles your backbone. Down your legs and arms, up your head, moves out your skin like a giggle. Fills this room. The house, the block. Anybody you want to pray for, it just washes through Edmonton, right through Alberta, the earth, the sky. The whole world. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share with all beings so there is no suffering.
So thank you for your great connection.